We Build Games Podcast with your host, Joe Marshall.
When you develop games for mobile devices as an indie developer, you'll quickly find out it's largely a thankless job. You spend a ton of effort and time creating something that literally could be deleted within hours of somebody downloading it, and then they quickly go back to watching reruns of Breaking Bad or moving on to another game that they'll most likely not be playing in a few days from now. This makes me wonder if all the effort and time is still worth it. I'm always on the lookout for quality games that are diamonds in the rough. And when I first got started learning to program for iPhone shortly after Apple announced the first SDK for developers, I ran across a game called EnzoDot, which you actually can't get anymore on the App Store. The object of the game was to connect the dots using one continuous loop while following a given pattern. It was made by the Kiefer brothers. David, Jonathan, and Michael Kiefer make up the KieferBros.com, a game studio in Appleton, Wisconsin.
We make puzzle games, mostly puzzle games anyways. We like to focus on premium, high-quality stuff that engages your mind.
That's David Kiefer. He's principal designer of the Kiefer Bros. What I love most about the studio is they make great quality games, and they also test and experiment on a regular basis with things that they're working on.
There's just three of us, so it's me and my two brothers. We are self-published, so not only are we developing the games, but we're publishing them, and it's a lot of work, so we all have to kind of do a whole lot of everything. So I end up doing a lot of the art, design, and music.
If you're a fan of word or puzzle games, you've probably played one of their more popular ones. Games like Orba, Monster Soup, Blockwick, Spell Rift, a game called Aqueduct, and recently they released Blockwick 2. And then quickly they surprised their fans with yet another game called Jollygrams. They have a very nice way of drawing you in with an atmospheric design. It's a big part of what makes the gameplay experience so engaging. When I see this level of quality going into mobile games, I always want to find out what goes on behind the scenes and if it was worth all the trouble. I reached out to David about the launch of Blockwick 2 to find out if all the time and effort was worth it.
Blockwick 2 is a slide and match puzzle game. So you're basically just trying to move blocks around. It's a lot of spatial reasoning and figuring out how do I move this block over here and get everything out of the way.
So on today's episode, we talk about the process of getting a mobile game out there in the world and if there's still value in promoting the game. Is it all still worth it? So you made a game, now what? I asked David what the process looks like at the time they released Blockwick 2. I was going to ask about the response. Is it what you guys expected? Was it more than you expected? Hopefully not less than you expected.
Thank you, first of all. But as far as the reception goes, like, we've just been so pleased. The reviews have been really positive. Customer reviews on the actual app stores, and then also just by game review sites and stuff. Sometimes we got surprised too. Time Magazine mentioned us as one of the best games of the month, and we were like, hey, we didn't even realize that, you know, people that big were paying attention to us. So that's been really cool. When we do a release, we send out a lot of press releases, but most of the time, you just get kind of ignored by a lot of people, especially, you know, the bigger guys in the media world. So, yeah, it was just a really fun surprise the day that they announced that.
When you send out press releases, are you guys doing a shotgun blast to all news outlets, or are you targeting specific people that you would like to cover the game?
It's kind of a little bit of both.
A little mixture?
Yeah, especially for people that we've developed relationships with. We take the time to personally correspond with them about stuff. But if it's somebody like Time Magazine, where we don't really have a relationship with them, we'll definitely just send them a standard press release.
Do you think it's actually worth indie game developers getting out there and making relationships with people in the press?
My answer to that would be totally dependent on whether or not you're planning on self-publishing. Because you can be an indie game studio and get published by somebody else and let them worry about press releases and stuff. But if you're planning on self-publishing, I think it's really important to take that stuff seriously, because without any exposure, like, nobody's going to know about your game.
So I go to Starbucks once in a while. I personally don't drink coffee, but I usually pick one up for my wife. And I noticed they always have the App of the Week card at the counter. And you guys actually had Blockwick 2 as an App of the Week through Starbucks. How in the world does that happen? It's got to be one of the coolest things as a game developer to see, like, your game being featured out in the real world.
Yeah, a lot of fun stuff has been happening to us lately. It's kind of weird. It's all happening at once. Yeah, Starbucks was also kind of one of those things where we were kind of surprised that it happened. We had been, I think, like, trying to get that pick of the week for about a year. I think we found the Starbucks guy on Twitter, and we had, like, reached out to him, and he kind of was like, oh, yeah. But then it ended up being this ongoing sort of conversation that culminated eventually in us getting pick of the week, but it was, the process started about a year ago, so
it took a while. Wow. Yeah. What are your thoughts on the free-to-play model versus the paid model in games?
Depending on your game, either model can make sense. There's certain types of games where you play the same thing over and over, like Tetris, and I think free-to-play can make a lot of sense for that type of game. For a game like Blockwick 2, where we have, like, a finite number of puzzles, the main game has 160 puzzles, and then there's, like, another additional 144. Like, there's a finite number of content, so you can only play it for so many hours before you're like, okay, I'm done. I'm ready to move on. So in that case, like, premium seems to make a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And philosophically, like, I personally am just much more of a premium type person. Like, I'd much rather have an engaging experience and not sort of be bugged by all these sort of extraneous monetization things like currency and like advertisements and stuff. Like, I'd rather be immersed in the game experience.
I've recently played a couple games where they actually integrate the ad experience as being part of the actual game, like, in order to, like, double the coin count or something like that. And I think that's kind of interesting. It is still keeping you kind of in the game because it's related to the game. I think they call it value exchange advertising or something. I'm not sure what the actual professional term is. I think in some instances like that, it may work out if it is a free game. I still just prefer upfront payment and get on with it.
Yep. And there's something to be said too about, one of the things that we've always really wanted was the ability to do demos for our games. Something where, like, people could download your game, they could play it for like 30 minutes or 5 hours or whatever, like, sort of the amount of time you want to give somebody, 24 hours. And then let them decide, okay, yeah, I think I like this, I want to pay for it. And in a way, in-app purchases can sort of facilitate that. Like, you could, you know, make a free download and then have them pay to get the full game. But it's not quite the same thing psychologically. When users get an app for free, they're not expecting to have to be cut off from the content that they have access to.
Do you prefer the graphic design or the music process better when you're working on a game?
Well, I do really enjoy both. It kind of comes down to what is more mentally active. So it's kind of a case-by-case thing. Like, I do so many different things and so many things I love, but sometimes anything can get really boring if your mind isn't engaged. So I really like anything that's involves critical thinking and solving interesting problems and being creative. So sometimes that can be music. Sometimes that can be the design side of things. Sometimes it can be as mundane as, like, some little tiny user interface element and figuring out what is the better user experience with this in, like, a little menu or something. So it really kind of varies from day to day.
What is your typical design workflow look like? Are you starting out, like, are you a old schooler sketches and paper type guy, and then you move into Photoshop, or do you just get right into the software? What do you prefer to work with if it's in your ideal environment?
Oh yeah, I definitely like to start with pencil and paper. That's just really easy to get things out, just really quickly hash out ideas and problem solve at a really sort of basic level. And then typically move on to computer stuff and start to translate those ideas and solve the problems once they're on the computer too.
The music aspect of it, when you start creating music, do you actually have, like, do you use a keyboard or do you just use the onboard software?
I have one of those little digital USB keyboards that plugs into the computer, and I kind of just plink around on the piano until I find some melodies that I think are going to work. And then I go into software stuff. I'm using Logic, I think is what it's called. Super powerful, like, sound editing composer tool made by Apple. And just play around with looping and reorganizing. And, yeah.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody recently that does music for games as well, and they said that they actually prefer to start out with a physical instrument if possible, because everyone has access to the same software tools so they can all press the same keys. And he believes that, you know, when he's actually playing a physical instrument, no one actually plays that same instrument the exact same way because it's like a human element involved. And I thought that was a really interesting answer. So I like to ask, you know, do you actually prefer to use physical instruments? And it turns out most people do, which is interesting, because I don't have musical talent and I would prefer to bang around on keys that make me sound good. But I guess when you actually have talent, right, you know, that's why you want to use a real thing, I guess. So
yeah, there's something about, maybe it goes hand in hand, or it's analogous with starting out with pencil and paper and starting out just on the piano, is there's something about developing, like, the core idea before fleshing it out too far and making sure that what you have is a solid design or a solid tune or, you know, what have you, and making sure that that core and that heart is what you want it to be before you fully sort of sculpt all the details.
Yeah, I completely agree. Especially the pencil and paper thing, even if you're just, like, mind mapping an idea out, they have mind mapping software. I'm not sure if you even get into that, but even the software is still, it's extremely slow as opposed to just grabbing a piece of paper and a pen and just, you know, sketching something out. I mean, it's just so much faster and it doesn't break your flow. And I think it's still way better than using software right away.
Yeah. I've been vaguely curious to try some of that mind mapping software. I've never tried it before, but it seems kind of interesting. I can say from another side of that too is, like, some people can use, like, their graphic tablet and, like, use that as a sketch pad, so to speak. But even that for me is not quite the same as just having paper.
I agree.
There's just sort of like this, just if you're in Photoshop and you're trying to sketch, there's all these distractions and changing colors and brush strokes, widths and softness of brush and all this, all these different settings that you can mess around with, where it's just pencil and paper. It's just you and your ideas.
The Kiefer Bros used to focus mainly on iPhone and iPad games, but they recently moved over to using Unity, which is a cross-platform game engine allowing you to make games that can be played on a lot of different devices. Right, yeah. BlockQuick 2 is on Steam, the Google Play, right? And Amazon?
Yeah. It's on 3-4 different marketplaces and 5 platforms, so...
Yeah, that's powerful. It's hard to overlook the benefits of using Unity as opposed to just going native with using iOS and the frameworks.
Yep.
Every time Apple keeps coming out with, like, an update to SpriteKit or another framework that helps create games, it's like, oh, this is, you know, I already know Objective-C and Swift and I can bang out some nice things, but then I always have Unity in the corner of my of my mind, just like, you know, calling me like, but you can be elsewhere in the world. It's not just all about Apple. And it's very enticing and tempting. And I do actually personally use Unity on a daily basis and mess around and learn things and experiment. And it's always calling me to get away from the Apple frameworks and start, you know, using Unity as the platform to make the games on so that I can distribute things elsewhere. So are you guys seeing a worthwhile success with that? Like, is it worth being on Google Play and Amazon and Steam, or is Apple still, like, as far as downloads go, like just crushing everyone, or is that not the case?
Well, as far as answering the question of was it worth it, if I just answered straight up downloads and monetarily, it probably wasn't worth it to be on all the different platforms. But the reason for that is that we've been making games for over 7 years now, and we've developed an audience on iOS, and we haven't really reached out to people on Android before. So it's sort of like we're new to the whole Android platform and we're new to the Android world. So it kind of makes a lot of sense that we would sell a lot of copies on iOS and hardly any on Android.
That's very true. Yeah, very true.
That being said, like, I think we all still think that it was worth it. And I think we're going to continue releasing for Android for sure. And probably for desktop. No guarantees on that, but because it is a lot of work supporting 5 different platforms and all the different marketplaces and stuff. But just in terms of the ability to expand our audience, that's something that's kind of key to our business model is actually building the audience for our studio. And if we can reach people on different platforms, that's amazing. Even if in the beginning it wasn't sort of financially worth it.
What's the future of gaming look like? Are we all wearing VR headsets, or are we still playing mobile games and not much has really changed?
I don't know. I hate to make predictions, especially when I have yet to ever try a VR headset. Which is funny because my Twitter feed is absolutely full of people talking about VR all the time, which I'm starting to get a little bit annoyed about, because I'm like, guys, I haven't tried it, so stop talking to me about it. There's a certain sort of timelessness about casual mobile games. And I think it goes to show when, like, you have some of the latest games that are like the top hits on the App Store are just remakes of really old games, and that there's something just really timeless and classic about a casual game that you can sort of just take out of your pocket, play it for a couple minutes, and then put it away. That's always going to be there, even if we have like these amazing virtual reality experiences where you're like going to a different fantasy world and, you know, being immersed in it for an hour or three. So yeah, I don't really see mobile going anywhere.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the best things about mobile is that I've heard other just normal people that do not consider themselves gamers, like, playing games on their phone quite often. And when you realize the frequency in which they are playing them, you could consider them a gamer. It doesn't have to be the person that spends 4 hours at Xbox and, you know, to be a gamer. I think it's the mobile game world, you know, per se. I think it really has turned a lot of people back into finding those little bits of time to enjoy games, because as you get older and you work more, I mean, you don't have time necessarily to sit down for 4 to 5 hours and play Bond.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a funny distinction too, the whole term gamer. There's lots of people who spend hours every day playing games but wouldn't necessarily associate themselves or think of themselves as gamers. But
right, yeah.
They're really dedicating a lot of their life to playing games. Interesting.
Yeah. What is your most downloaded or most popular game, do you guys think, that's out there? Is it Monster Soup? Is it Aqueduct?
I think our top-selling game is still Aqueduct. It's pretty old now, too.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it, I think we released that in like 2010 or maybe 2011. But it's one of those games where we didn't really know what was going to happen with it, but it just has kind of always stuck around, and I think it's never like hit the top charts or anything, but it somehow always seems to get mentioned when people are like, hey, got any good puzzle games that you want to play? And people are like, oh, if you haven't played Aqueduct, you got to try it. So
yeah, I was at my mom's house a few months back, and I noticed that her iPad, she had Monster Soup, and I was like, what, how'd you find this game? She's like, I just found it on the App Store. It's really nice. And I was just like, wow, it's completely weird. Cause I don't talk to her about like, you know, games that I play on, mm-hmm. on mobile or anything like that. It was just really ironic to see that, you know, your games are being played by people that, you know, I would never expect to actually play games at all. Like, my mom's not really somebody that spends a lot of time in games, but although mm-hmm. lately with mobile, she actually has been, which is, again, a weird thing. But,
well, that's a lot of fun. And there you go again, like, people who wouldn't necessarily normally think of themselves as gamers are finding themselves, like, spending time with stuff and really finding value in it.
Yeah.
And enjoying.
Every time I launch Monster Soup, and if my wife's, you know, around in the room, she's like, oh, that music is perfect. it reminds her of like a score soundtrack, you know, and it kind of, in a way, it really does. I mean, you guys do great work with that.
Thank you very much.
According to App Annie, Blockquick 2 is currently being featured in two category spots. Do you know about that?
If it is somewhere, it's probably featured somewhere obscurely. Which kind of seems to be what usually happens with our games, which is kind of cool, but also could be better.
Yes, it's frustrating to me, actually, that, you know, I haven't seen something pop up on the front page that totally deserves to be on the front page, but it's strange how that works out.
The thing is, Apple has a ton of feature slots, and some of them are like front and center, so when you open the App Store on your phone, like, you see this, you know, this new game that came out, and then they have other ones that you sort of have to dig to find. And so I think I want to say for like the past probably 4 years, maybe past 3 years, everything that we've put out, we've gotten some sort of feature slot, but I can't recall a time when we've sort of had the sort of front page spotlight. And I don't know, you could chalk that up to just bad luck that we've been releasing our games when other bigger studios are releasing their games, or we're happy to be featured at all, because it's one of those things where it's this sort of mysterious, mm-hmm. nebulous thing where developers all over the internet are wondering, like, how do we get featured by Apple? We don't know, but we're happy when it does happen, even if it is in an obscure place. We're happy and grateful for it.
Do you think Apple gives some of the larger companies a certain amount of front page coverage just because they see those larger companies as a safer bet in a way?
I kind of speculate that there's a lot of sort of behind the scenes stuff that goes on, especially when you're dealing with the really big publishers like EA and Rovio. You kind of would think, how could there not be, like,
right?
At least some sort of, like, I don't know, just making sure that the big players are happy, you know. That kind of only makes sense, I guess.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, they do want to make money. I mean, so
yep, yeah, definitely.
Do you prefer to play mobile games on your phone or your tablet, or do you have a tablet? I guess I shouldn't assume that, you know, you.
Yeah, actually, I do have both. We've bought too many Apple devices over the past couple of years, for testing purposes, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, it kind of just depends on the game. I think I would venture to guess that any game has sort of an ideal form. Like, for instance, I love playing crossword puzzles on my iPhone, and it just seems like the perfect format, and I love it. I've tried it on the iPad, and it's not as good to me. But something like a point-and-click adventure game like Machinarium is just amazing. Like, I've played it on computer and tablet, and the tablet is just such a perfect platform for sort of a point-and-click adventure.
There are a few games that I actually prefer to play on the iPhone as well, but like The Silent Age, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that game. That's perfect for iPad.
I am familiar with that game. I actually only played that on my iPhone, though, so I'm I'm going to have to try it on the tablet.
Yeah, you're missing out.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to play the games that are on the front page of Apple to get an idea or a sense of what people are playing? Or do you think that doesn't matter at all? Like, sometimes I'll play games that I would be embarrassed as a you know, person that plays games to say that I played it, but I'm actually really playing it to see if there's an actual purpose or point of why it's gained so much popularity, and
right.
to see if there's like maybe a gameplay mechanic that actually makes sense for mobile a lot more, and that's what people are liking about it. Because it seems to me like there's a giant audience of people out there that love to play extremely quick, simple games that are really designed to not really necessarily think, but just designed to give you like a few minutes of enjoyment and then you put it away. And
yeah,
I just think it might be important for developers to not always bury their head in the sand with their own games they're working on.
Right. Yeah. We definitely, for our games, we choose to what we work on just is what we want to work on. It's what we feel like working on. But yeah, like I definitely get curious of, like, what is it about Candy Crush that keeps people coming back to it? I personally don't download them. I let my wife download it, and then I watch her play the games.
Right.
But yeah, I guess once in a while I do download that. I guess we try not to get too focused on sort of trying to unlock the secrets of what these mega hits are doing. Just because I think there's a lot of sort of fad element and luck element to it. And, you know, we don't want to get too wrapped up in how can we replicate what these guys are doing.
Sure,
and
sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, definitely I like to try to keep an eye on sort of trends and fads.
Are you guys currently working on anything right now that you could tell us about?
Actually, we just submitted an update to Blackwick 2 to Apple yesterday. It's been probably the most arduous update we've ever done, but I'm also really excited about it coming out. It's an update. It's a puzzle pack for Blackwick 2. It's going to be called Obscura, and it's full of like the really challenging puzzles that we wanted to put in the main game, but our beta testing told us that we really shouldn't put them in the main game because they're too hard. So I'm super pumped about it because our hardcore fans are going to really like it. It's 80 puzzles, and it goes from kind of medium difficulty to totally mind-blowingly insanely difficult, which, that's a little bit of an evil chuckle there.
Yeah, no doubt.
It definitely took us a lot of time to work on, though, just because testing those really difficult puzzles just takes a lot of time. So
one of the other things that's perfect about the game is that, you know, you work on what seems like a really hard puzzle, and then you'll have a few that are kind of like, you know, to get your brain back from melting, and then it ramps back up again. The balance of challenge in the game is extremely well done. I guess, was that your intention from the beginning, like to create like this kind of like roller coaster of difficulty, or did you just come about that towards the end, like we should kind of mix and match it? Because I think it almost seems like you have to have that idea built in from the beginning, because it's just the way it's weighted is just so perfect.
That was our intention from the beginning, because we've played like a ton of different puzzle games, other studios puzzle games, and our own puzzle games. Our feeling was that like you want the first part of the game to be easy, and you want the end of the game to be hard, and you want sort of a gradual progression, you know, from easy to hard. But along the way, you don't want just every single puzzle to feel like that one was slightly harder than the last one. That one was slightly like you want these sort of mini ups and downs, and that just creates a better experience, I think, overall.
Is Michael the one that's usually behind the game design, creating the puzzles?
That's a shared responsibility between Michael and I.
Do you guys like have, how do you guys like, do you start with the end in mind? Like, okay, this is what the end of the board's going to look like. And then you like move it around and kind of reverse the process. It seems like it would be incredibly difficult to come up with extremely challenging puzzles. Like some of them, I want to like tear my hair out and then what I love about it is I'm at the point of like tearing my hair out. And then I realize, oh, I'm only two moves away from solving it. And it's like, oh, and it, like, I've had that happen numerous times where I'm like, oh yeah, just move it here. Yeah, done. Wow. I can't believe I didn't see that. Like, you know, like, I mean, it's great. Like, do you guys, is that like a trade secret you don't want to talk about? Or like, how do you guys, like, do you reverse the process? I don't even know how you would begin to like, know, like, okay, this path is going to frustrate people really, really, really good. You know, like.
We don't necessarily intend for puzzles to be frustrating. There's just something weird, I think, that the mind, the human mind does when it plays a Blackwick puzzle, where it just gets stuck in this rut of thinking, like, I have to move this block here and I have to move this block here so I can get this block over here. And you keep sort of thinking that same thing and you end up like trying the same thing over and over like a crazy person, even though you're not sort of consciously trying to do that. You just sort of subconsciously think, well, it has to work this way because that's the way it looks like it should work. And then if you just step back and like, you know, like walk away for 10 minutes and then come back to it, then you sort of look at it in a different way and you're like, oh, duh, that's super simple. All you have to do is bring it around the other way. So when it comes to designing the puzzles, there's not really any set method. It's just, it's one of those things, like we've been designing puzzles for 7 years. So it's just kind of a feeling thing. And we've been doing it for so long. It's just, you kind of just do it. I don't really have a secret formula.
Yeah, you guys are great at it. And when I say frustrating, I don't mean like I want to throw the game down because it's terrible. Like, it's challenging me, which my brain likes, you know? So it's like, it's that good frustration, that experience that, you know, this is more challenging than it should be feeling. And
yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you.
It's great. A big thanks to David for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. The music for this episode was from Monster Soup and Blackwick 2 soundtracks, composed by David, which you can get at kieferbros.bandcamp.com. And you can always find the music, games, and other great things on their website at kieferbros.com. That's KieferBros.com. And I'll have the links to the show information at WeBuildGames.com or WBG.FM. You can subscribe to We Build Games, the podcast, on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Next week, we stumble upon the process that can greatly improve your chances of getting your game on the front page of the Apple App Store, and our guest has successfully used it 3 out of 3 times to do just that. All that and more next time.